It was once known as the Global Rules-Based Order. Now Peter Harcher says we could better call it Fight Club. As the US throws punches wildly at smaller countries and China grabs the maritime territories of its neighbours to build military bases, the disregard for the traditional international order is stunning. Not only are the two major powers hitting each other with trade sanctions and divvying up the world's economy into competing blocks, they're bulking up military spending. In the last 2 weeks, companies in the US, Japan, and Germany have been forced to choose to do business with America or China, but not both. So far, they're choosing America. Citizens of the countries are up for this conflict. For example, this song you're hearing was made by a Chinese patriot and is celebrating the trade war. This went viral. Unexpectedly and abruptly, globalisation suddenly seems like a quaint old notion. This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. This week, as conflict becomes the norm, are we heading for a resounding clash? Joining us later is our Beijing correspondent Kirsty Needham to talk about the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre and the ripples sent through the world as China is forced to grapple with its legacy. But first, we're joined by two people who've been watching the world change their entire careers. Peter Harcher and Nick O'Malley, thank you for joining Please Explain again.
Pleasure, Tori.
Peter, just returned from the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. What is that event?
It's an annual get-together for the defence ministers, heads of armed forces from pretty much everywhere in the world, but it's centred on, obviously, Singapore. So it tends to be heavily in Indo-Pacific, which is the current phrase we're supposed to use, talking about the region. And it brings, so this year, the two-star events were the US Defence Secretary, or at the moment acting, because Donald hasn't made his final choice, Patrick Shanahan. And the big news this year was that the Chinese sent their defence minister, who they haven't sent one for 8 years now. So there was a lot of attention on both the China and US defence secretaries as they squared up to each other.
It's a very good time for that discussion, isn't it?
Well, that's the question. Is there going to be any discussion, or did we just see a restatement of positions? Are these two countries that are now well advanced in a major confrontation across trade, across commerce, across espionage, cybersecurity, you name it, they're at loggerheads, just going to restate their positions? And what we saw was the US claiming, the acting defence secretary Shanahan, Patrick Shanahan, said, we're no longer going to sit idly by and we're going to name China's misbehaviour. And then he ran through a whole laundry list of Chinese misbehaviour, according to the US. But what the room waited for, and one of the delegates actually asked, was, yeah, but we hear this every year. What are you going to do that's different? And Shanahan had no response. And then the next day, when the Chinese defence minister Wei had his turn, he got up and basically delivered a very combative speech, which was not only claiming that China was right in every possible way, but that the US was the disruptor, defended everything, including the Tiananmen Square massacre.
And on the eve of the 30th anniversary.
On the eve of the anniversary, that's right. And even reassured us that the million-plus ethnic minority Uyghur population of northern China were being held in permanent detention, not against their own will and not as a repressive policy, as the UN tells us it is, but to help them with their re-education and to get their social attitudes in tune with the times.
Right. In your column in the papers on Tuesday, you described the new world order as a fight club.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the rules-based order was supposed to be a system of rules that meant that that constrained everybody, but particularly the biggest powers. And that's a system, of course, that works for smaller and middle powers like us. But when you have the two biggest powers breaking every possible rule, and, you know, the system's never been perfect and it's never been perfectly observed. The invasion of Iraq was a case study. It had no UN authorization and it was not a legitimate exercise. It also turns out to have been a disaster, but that's another story. But in general, it was observed. And what we now see is that both the biggest powers, the US and China, systematically, as a matter of policy, not just one-off interventions, as a matter of policy, break the rules. So the most spectacular case in terms of China, of course, was its seizing the maritime territories of its neighbours, not only breaching the UN law of the sea, but also an explicit ruling against China that was delivered from the tribunal at The Hague when the Philippines appealed against China taking its territory. So that's the Chinese case. And in the US, the clearest, most systematic violation of the so-called rules-based order now is trade sanctions. Mm. Trump, with sometimes only the barest pretense at trying to say they're in any way legal or legitimate, just slaps them on anyone. And just in the last week, we've seen them go on to Mexico, India, more on China, almost on Australia.
He doesn't actually seem to know how they work either. That's the most confounding thing, is he keeps thinking or saying that he's of the view that the country upon whom he's slapping the tariffs are paying the tariffs.
Has to pay it.
Yeah, that's right. He thinks that if you put a tariff on China, Chinese products, that the Chinese companies pay that. But of course it's not. It's the American buyers who end up paying it.
And we have reports from his own advisors saying they've been in, they've tried to explain this, but he won't have it.
So, Nick, how much of this breakdown in the rules of diplomacy do you put down to these two men, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping?
I think they've speeded up a process which has been going on for a long time. China, to be fair, it didn't get to write the rules. The rules were written largely after World War II, and China wasn't a player. And since it's had the muscle to assert its claim that it didn't write the rules, it's now been acting on that assertion, and there's some argument in the right. But what we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years, I suppose, is the rules-based order, which has served us, you know, in that period pretty well, just taking all of these hits. David Ignatius, the Washington Post writer, he's got a nice analogy. He describes the rules-based order is, I can't remember if it's a kid on a skateboard or a kid on a bush bike riding down a hill. It can take a hit or two. He can take a hit or two. He's a good rider and get the wobbles and re-establish and move on. But over recent years, there have been more and more hits and less time between them to re-establish momentum. I think Ignatius writes about September the 11th being the first. You could go back further and say the Iranian Revolution was. But then you had the response to September the 11th, which, as Peter says, was catastrophic with the invasion of Iraq. You had the 2008 financial crisis. And then you have populism and the rise of Trump, which is arguable as to whether it's a hit or if it's a symptom or a cause. I'd say it's both. But there is less and less stability and less chance to regain momentum between these knocks to the order. And those actors, on a minor scale and on a grand scale, who would seek to benefit from instability, understand this. So Russia trying to hive off America from its European allies, they're seeding instability, or meddling in the election, they're seeding instability. Brenton Tarrant trying to foster and increase extremism on that tiny scale. They're all actors who understand that a chaotic environment is good for those people who don't like stability.
Can I have a stab at the same question? Sure. About whether the influence of these two particular leaders, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, have had on the process. I think they've been fundamental, and they state it. Donald Trump, make America great again. It's a project that appeals to naked nationalism. And in a, as we all know, a populist way. And my definition for populism is overly simplistic solutions to complex questions, unworkably simplistic. And Xi Jinping has done the same. I'd point to two of his key pronouncements, possibly the most important strategic declaration of this century, which is almost nobody paid any attention to in the West, was 2013 when Xi Jinping overturned the strategic maxim that had governed and guided all of China's actions, which was when Deng Xiaoping said in the 1980s, we have to hide our brightness and bide our time. Xi Jinping overturned that in 2013 when he said, this is now the time to strive to achieve. That's the key phrase, strive to achieve. No longer hiding, no longer waiting. This is it. His second pronouncement was, and this is more famous, I suppose, where he said, I want the China dream. We all have to strive for the China dream, which he then describes as the rejuvenation of the great Chinese nation. So both Trump and Xi Jinping have very categorically set out these new nationalist projects of national greatness based on nationalist, jingoist appeal to the people, and they're on a collision course.
And how worried should we be?
I think we should be worried. At every stage that this has gone on, whenever people have said, oh, look, it's just a bit of theatre and positioning, they'll back down, they're going to get rational again, because trade wars aren't rational, right, because they hurt both sides, for example. It never happens. It just intensifies and the range of hostilities broadens. And we now see in the commercial relationship between the US and China, which is the world's biggest trade relationship, it's a massive relationship, but we now see increasingly it being pulled apart by, essentially, this is coming from the American end, but they're pulling it apart. They're saying, and it started with the Huawei ban, but it's now much wider. It's going across electronic components suppliers, software suppliers. So Google has decided not to supply its software anymore to Chinese telecoms companies. We see Japanese, German component suppliers cutting off their sales now to China, to Huawei and other companies. If they want to do business with the US, they have to cut off China. Companies and countries are now being forced to choose. Do we want to work with the Americans or with the Chinese? The wall is coming down between the two of them. And it's people for a little while now have been warning that this is heading towards a decoupling, that is ripping apart really globalization.
So where does that leave us? Because Scott Morrison, just before the election, when he was confronted with the prospect of having to choose a side, said, I don't want to choose between our friends and our customers, which was a slightly inelegant thing to say about the Chinese.
Oh, I think we're increasingly awkward position because, Scott Morrison doesn't want to talk about this stuff. So at this moment, as we speak, Australia is under an undeclared trade embargo from China. The Chinese have banned imports of Australian thermal coal. But our government doesn't want to talk about it. In fact,
The Chinese government.
No, the Chinese, they like to keep it ambiguous. They want to train you. And they've used, economic coercion is a standard tool of Chinese statecraft. This is not new. It's just new that it's being applied to us and it's being applied on a major commodity. But they want to train countries so that we will anticipate their anger and therefore bend over backwards to be nice to them at all costs. So they don't want to talk about it. They always keep it ambiguous. Scott Morrison doesn't want to talk about it because he doesn't want to draw attention to it. And then if he does, people will say, well, what are you going to do about it? He doesn't want that pressure. Likewise, Donald Trump has named Australia in this absurd conspiracy theory where we were supposed to be conspiring with the Brits and the Ukrainians against Trump to get an investigation going into Russian collusion. I mean, nonsense.
This relates to Alexander Downer's night on the tiles.
That's right, where he was supposedly spying on a former Trump staffer and then rushing off Now, this is complete garbage, but likewise, our government hasn't breathed a word about that either. We don't want to talk about it because it's awkward and uncomfortable. And where it's all heading, Tory, is towards the day when Australia is forced to a choice. Do we want to do business with the US or do we want to deal with China? Is it possible to do both? Can you accommodate a partial ban on one and not the other? How do those two countries react? So as the two big powers intensify their confrontation, Australia is sitting there nervously sweating. Are we going to have to answer that same question? Which country do we want to do business with?
I'd argue as well that the whole question for this government, for our new government, is complicated by the fact that it's almost impossible to anticipate what our greatest ally will do. Once upon a time, you could anticipate that. What's more, you could have the backdoor conversation so you'd actually know what they were going to do. And now we just don't know what Trump will do. It does seem, though, that there is a theme that the United States is becoming a revisionist power. It has always been, or at least since World War II, it's been the source of stability. And the only consistency about Trump's foreign policy is that he doesn't want to be that. He wants to tear apart what were the norms that governed us all. And for an Australian government to try and pick a course through this at the moment it would seem to me to be almost impossible. It doesn't have a power authority in its own right, and it doesn't have the strength and predictable nature of its relationship with the United States to rely upon.
That's a great point. The US has become a revisionist power as it goes around tearing up rules and norms and seeking to change the world. But the same is also true of China now. China used to be a status quo power until that moment in 2013 when Xi Jinping said, it's strive to achieve. At that moment, they also became a disruptive power, and that's why the world is now in such a state of turmoil, indecision, conflict, because both the great powers are revisionists.
And what I find particularly scary about that is I can't see a particularly strong incentive on either power at the moment to take a backward step. You have to accept what the United States has done under Donald Trump so far. That's the world we live in. And if you're trying to pick a course that is good for the United States from this position, well, then you kind of have to follow through at least on some of what he's doing, which is to consider that if you're going to challenge China, better to do it now than in 10 years' time when it is unquestionably an authority. So once you've taken this course, you kind of have to follow it through, and China's in the same position. It's picked the fight with the United States. It can't really back down now without conceding the huge gains it's made under this policy over the past few years.
Now, we're obviously not in the prediction game, and I would, as you both pointed out, these two men are impossible to predict what they're going to do. But at what point are we at risk of this trade war escalating into something more scary?
I think it's well on the way to being there already. If you look at the US has now, by a factor of 4-1, its biggest military deployment is in what they call Indo-PACOM, Indo-Pacific Command, based in Hawaii. So compared to any of their other geographic commands, the Chinese are hurtling headlong into a military spend up and modernization program. And the two of them are positioning, and this is going on as a matter of daily priority for both these powers now, for a future crisis. The Chinese, for example, this is just one example, have almost finished their own global GPS system. Until now, they've used the American system. There are only two countries that have bothered. Why would you bother to create one? Everyone uses the American system, except for the Russians, because they don't trust the Americans, and in the event of a crisis, they want to be separate, stand alone. The Chinese have now done the same thing. The Chinese have militarized space. A few months ago, they shot down, they used a laser to destroy one of their own defunct weather satellites. It was a test. So the Chinese are contesting every domain. They're not relenting, and we suffer some of the extensions of this, like last week, those Australian ships passing through the South China Sea, whose helicopter pilots were zapped in the eyes with laser lighting to try and befuddle them and scare them out of the South China Sea. It was fishing boats that did it, apparently. No guessing, no need to guess where they're from. They're Chinese, because they're using this on the Americans as well. The Chinese are trying to force the Americans out of their zone of influence. The Americans aren't budging. Where does that lead? Neither side stepping down. These are two leaders who have engaged nationalism. That is the source of their political power, both Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. Once you've engaged nationalism, where's the off-ramp? Which side's going to blink? And we heard from China's defense minister, General Wei, just on the weekend. He said, if the Americans want to talk, we'll talk. If they want to fight, we will fight to the end. There's no, you can't walk away from that. Perhaps the best chance of an off-ramp is the only condition Trump has put on this sort of ramp up against China has been, we'll keep doing this trade war stuff, but I'm also got an eye on Wall Street. If Wall Street does hit the boom, boom, the wall, and there's a major disaster because of the trade war that he's got going on with the Chinese, maybe that would get Trump to back off, and he's inherently unpredictable. Who knows? But that's the best chance I can see of a known variable changing the balance of thinking in the Trump White House.
Nick, you and I both grew up in a time when we were just terrified of the Russians dropping nuclear bombs on us. I don't know why we personally thought that was going to happen to us here in, the southern end of the world. But our kids, should they be afraid of this?
I think they should be, certainly, I think they should be afraid of that. And this is not to say it's about to happen, but I think they should be afraid of aggressive powers with nuclear weapons and some of their friends developing those nuclear weapons and perhaps spreading them, just as they should be afraid of climate change. These are the two outside pressures which are contributing further to instability, especially since you can imagine in a short time there'll be a huge numbers of people moving due to climate change. So, yeah, I think we almost stopped thinking about those machines for so long, because they're a horrible thing to think about. They affect us too terribly to think about seriously. This is Martin Amis's argument in his essay about Einstein's monsters, which I had a look at when I knew we were going to be talking about this. And I think now is the time to be talking about the, you know, the potential for catastrophe again.
So finally, Scott Morrison now has he's now the elected Prime Minister, so that will probably give him some confidence. He's currently this week in London. What advice would you give him as to how to deal with this current situation?
I think Australia can only continue to advocate for stability and the rules-based order. That's not to say that it'll have a significant impact. But as Peter says, the advantages to the middle powers of that set of rules is far higher than to any other nation on earth, or to the major nations. And so we need to be arguing for it. We need to be arguing for order and rules and considering, I hate to use the term, but communal benefit, the benefit of us all, of all systems. And I think that needs to happen domestically and in foreign policy. Whether or not that'll achieve anything is not possible, but it could demonstrate to other regional middle powers that we remain good actors. And perhaps in concert with them, we can have some impact.
Well, we've got to choose. In fact, I would suggest we've already chosen. Do we stick with a US ally, which has become unpredictable and may end up being pretty messy, but is still an ally, and it still has a lot. We still have a lot of connections. Australia benefits from a lot of their military facilities, their intelligence systems. We get all our military procurement stuff. That we get, you know, some of their best high tech stuff. Do we persist with that despite Trump and beyond Trump, or do we dump that to keep our credentials good with the Chinese, who are going to continue as a major economic power, even though certainly not at the same pace they've been for the last 40 years. And the question will come, are we prepared to pay an economic price to offend the Chinese by siding with the US? And I would say to you that we've already made that, and Morrison's been part of that decision. Most notably, he was the treasurer when the Huawei decision was taken, and he was the one who co-announced it. He was part of the decision to reform the Foreign Investment Review Board, to put a former ASIO chief as its chair. In other words, this is now a national security screening mechanism to keep the Chinese out, essentially. Australia has taken a bunch of decisions like that, which are all consistently shoring up our sovereignty, including the foreign interference laws that the Turnbull government passed was one of its last accomplishments. These are all ways of saying we are going to protect our sovereignty against Chinese intrusion, and we're going to stick with the alliance with the US. And we are paying a price with that day by day. The thermal coal embargo that the Chinese have got on Australian products, Australian coal shipments, we are already paying a price to retain our sovereignty against Chinese demands on our allegiance. And Scott Morrison's been part of that. He doesn't talk about it. This is a subject which is fundamental to our national future, but nobody in government wants to talk about it openly. But it's the big story of our times. And I would say that Scott Morrison has already decided. He's been part of those movements, and he's going to continue.
Mm. Well, I wouldn't say it's depressing, but it is worrying, and life can be short, so I think we should just all go for lunch.
Good plan.
Peter Harcher is the international and political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and Nick O'Malley is a senior writer and former US correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the investigations and foreign editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe and the US. Both are expensive but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
In 1989, Chinese security forces massacred hundreds, possibly thousands, of student protesters agitating for a more transparent government and an end to corruption. 30 years on, and the anniversary barely draws a whisper in mainland China. Our correspondent Kirsty Needham had to travel to Hong Kong to be able to tell us this story. Hi, Kirsty. How are you going?
I'm good, thanks, Tori.
Whereabouts are you?
Well, I'm in Hong Kong, and you might ask, why is the Beijing correspondent in Hong Kong? And there's a particular reason. It's the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And in Beijing on mainland China, there's a complete blackout on any discussion of this or any public commemoration. So I remember 15 years ago, I was in Beijing. I was working for a Chinese company. And I tried an experiment. I tried bringing up an image of Tank Man, that iconic image, on my computer at work. And the young people around me just didn't recognize it. When I went to Tiananmen Square that evening after work, there was really heavy police and security presence, but there was nothing going on at the square. So the Beijing foreign correspondents based in China know that if we were to wanting to write about or to report on the 30th anniversary, Beijing's not the place to do it because of that very heavy censorship. And we've come to Hong Kong, where there'll be a vigil this evening where tens, perhaps even over 100,000 Hong Kong people are expected to come out and light candles and commemorate the crackdown on students 30 years ago. It's a very moving tradition that's happened every year since 1990, I think the year after the massacre. And so that's what we'll be looking for this evening.
And so, Kirsty, what's the mood like in Hong Kong? Is there an increased sense of security or tension around this anniversary?
There is an increased sense of tension and concern around this anniversary. In the past, I remember being here for this vigil in 2004, and it was quite common then for former student leaders and, you know, Chinese students who'd taken part in 1989 to travel to Hong Kong and to address the crowd and speak to the media. But they're pretty much banned now. So on Sunday, one of the former student leaders from the Tiananmen Square incident had tried to enter Hong Kong and was turned back. And this is part of a trend that really does concern Hong Kong people. They were promised one country, two systems when this former British colony was handed over to China in 1997, and that included their own immigration controls and their own legal status, but they feel that this is being gradually eroded by Beijing. So that's why there's concern in the city at the moment about an extradition law. So at the moment, it's not possible for someone from Hong Kong to be extradited to the mainland if they're wanted for crimes there. And this has been described as part of a firewall that had been put up in the legal system to stop human rights abuses. But the current Hong Kong government is looking to change that. So that has brought protesters out onto the streets in recent weeks. And that's why we think there might be a bigger crowd in Hong Kong for this Tiananmen vigil tonight.
Right. I want to go back to what you said at the beginning about young people in China not even knowing about the Tiananmen Square massacre. It was such a huge cultural event here in Australia 30 years ago. Anyone who was alive at the time remembers the horror of what happened, remembers the then Prime Minister Bob Hawke's reaction to it and his tears in Parliament about the slaughter, and his decision, his completely unilateral decision to allow Chinese students who were here studying on short-term visas to stay for a number of years. It really was a big moment in the shaping of modern Australia. And to think that there's a whole generation of Chinese people who don't even know that it happened is just impossible to fathom. How has the Chinese government made this happen?
It is hard to believe, isn't it, coming from Australia, but it's this ruthless control of technology and the great firewall on the internet. And it's actually, surprisingly, it's gotten this censorship and ability to control what the media people consume has gotten stronger over the last 10 years. So most social media apps, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, these things that young people in Australia, it's so much part of their daily life, they're just not accessed in China unless you have a special device called a virtual private network that journalists, amongst others, use to get through the firewall. But that's how they've been able to completely, you know, wipe out some of those iconic images and knowledge. And I mean, the fact that young students in Beijing now don't know that students just like them 30 years ago had been killed in Tiananmen Square. It's quite hard to believe. But one caveat on that, and perhaps a sign of hope, is that in recent years, as we've seen more Chinese students travelling overseas to study in places like Australia and America. They are being exposed to this news and to some of this footage and do carry that knowledge back with them when they return to China. So that's an interesting trend as well.
Do people not talk about it? I mean, it's one thing to not be able to download pictures, but do people's parents not tell them the story? Are they too afraid?
Well, that's one thing. Look, that some Chinese people who work in the media are sort of reminding us about this week. Look, that there's absolutely no public discussion. There's no media reporting. There's no gatherings. That would be too dangerous. But surely people are learning about it from their parents and family members. So that's interesting. Yeah.
Is there any hint that you've seen of any sort of organised underground movement of people trying to tell this story?
A lot of it's based out of places like Hong Kong and Taiwan, yeah. And that's where a lot of the former student leaders and protesters fled to and now live in exile. There's one main group still in Beijing called the Tiananmen Mothers, and I don't know if we'd even call them sort of activists or underground, but they simply are the mothers of who had lost their children in this incident and just refuse to, you know, to keep quiet about it. And they want justice, they want an investigation. And so a lot of the people that are living in exile, these Tiananmen mothers who are, you know, largely under house arrest at the moment, so every year in the period leading up to June 4, access to them by the media, by the public is blocked by security forces in a very heavy-handed way that people physically can't go in to visit and talk to them. But what they're wanting and continue to call for quite bravely is simply an investigation. And if you think about when there's been major incidents in Australia where there's been loss of life, a terrorist incident, an accident, there's always a public investigation afterwards that can be quite cathartic for people to sort of fully understand what happened and to give them a sense of justice. And that is what is missing 30 years on in China.
So there's still death toll, is there, really? We don't even really know how many people died.
That's right. So the Chinese government had insisted, you know, a week later, I think they said a few hundred. The Chinese Red Cross, who had been in touch with the hospitals, gave it as closer to 2,600. And then there were cables that have recently been declassified in recent years from the US and British emissaries, saying it could have been as high as 10,000. That seems quite high, but it highlights the fact that unless and until there's an official investigation, we just do not know.
Mm. Kirsty, just finally, this weekend in Singapore at the Shangri-La Dialogue, the Chinese Defence Minister made a very provocative set of comments about the Tiananmen massacre on the eve of the anniversary. He said that it was the correct decision and that they were just quelling political protest and it was the right thing to do. Were you surprised by those comments?
I was absolutely surprised. I guess it had been known that the Chinese government felt that this crackdown had brought stability and, they continue to point to China's economic success, now the second largest economy in the world. But for a defence minister to say that publicly in an international forum and to say it so close to such a sensitive anniversary was very, very surprising and would be quite hurtful, I think, to a lot of those victims and former protesters that still have these burning questions in their mind about why did our government open fire on students.
Well, Kirsty, thanks so much for your time. We'll let you get back to the streets of Hong Kong.
Great. Thanks, Tori. Cheers.
Kirsty Needham is the China correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Thanks to our guests this week, China correspondent Kirsty Needham, our foreign editor Peter Harcher, and senior writer Nick O'Malley. We've really enjoyed getting your feedback and ideas. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is in the show notes for this episode. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscribers power our award-winning journalism, and it's never been a better time to support us. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Thanks to the team behind this week's episode, our producer and editor David Escort, Amelia Maguire for taking care of our logistics and planning, David McMillan manages our recordings, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.